So there's the year that we call the Voldemort year, the year which must not be named. Except it turns out that it's really the most important year of my farming career so far. So this was 2006, and when I was transitioning out of the legal career, and I had a little parcel of land on the farm where I trained at. And I got to grow whatever I wanted there. So I started with high hopes and about 20 pounds of really pricey heirloom dry bean seeds. And I'll tell you what, hope, no matter what its intensity, is no substitute for planning. So on fine spring morning, I sashay on out. I'm wearing my cute little tank top and, yes, overalls. And the fact that I even cared what I looked like indicated that maybe a little more preparation had been in order. Anyway, I plant the seeds, and then about a week later, up come these little green rows, and I'm just so pleased with myself because, oh, look, I'm a farming prodigy on the first try. And it looked great for about another week or two, and then other little green things started coming up in between. And 3 years of apprenticing taught me, if nothing else, how to weed, so weed I did, except it got harder and harder to keep up, and pretty soon I was not keeping up in the least. So as the weeds grew, the more I tended to stay away on the theory that if I didn't know how bad it was, you know, it wouldn't be that bad. Then I get a call from the farm manager who says, look, if you don't do something about your weed problem, we're going to go out there and rototill it all in. Crop, weeds, and drip tape. So I get back out there, see how bad it is, and panic, and decide that the only thing to do, because the red pigweed is like this tall, right? And I decide that the only thing to do is do panic purchase a $700 tri-built rotor tiller and take it out there and try and solve the problem that way. Except the thing of it was, it was more like felling trees than weeding, and the thing was a rear tine thing, which was conveniently within reach of my pant legs. So it was, you know, scary and expensive and really not the thing to do. So that first year, after all of that, I harvested 1-quart canning jar of seed. And it could have been an occasion for giving up this whole farming thing, except I really wanted to do this. And the next year, I did it better. And for the longest time, I didn't talk about that year because I was so mortified at all of the mistakes I made, and I mean every mistake in the book. And the reason I wanted to do this presentation is for the benefit of people who want to try growing heirloom dry beans and save you a lot of trouble. So, all right, so why grow beans in the first place? And there's probably a lot of bean fanatics in this room, because they tend to draw fans. Beans are nutritionally dense, shelf-stable, gluten-free, vegan, plant-based protein. They pretty much ring all the bells. They are often included in food plans for frugal households, and they're found on menus of fine dining restaurants, even in New York. The New York Times, by the way, seems to have discovered heirloom dry beans, given all the recent articles they've had about them. Of course, the heirloom dry bean grower that they reference all the time is Rancho Gordo in California, and he does do great stuff. But this is part of an effort to establish the Midwest as a premier heirloom dry bean growing location in the United States. So their high fiber content is really great for the gut biome, microbiome, and for human health. There's tons of research that shows that eating beans on a regular basis is good for preventing heart disease, diabetes, and they lower blood sugar, and they're good for you in all kinds of ways. Let's see. All right, there we go. They're also delicious. If you've ever eaten a supermarket bean and wondered what all the excitement of beans were about, you'd be forgiven, because they're kind of like almost a different species. But when you grow your own, you're eating them as fresh as they can be. and there's a whole different flavor profile to them. Beans tend to not be strongly flavored to begin with, and but some of them do have subtle flavors, and the texture is what really puts them over the top. They can have textures that range from rice-like to potato-like to meaty, and they avoid that mealy kind of consistency that you can get from supermarket beans, which have been sitting there for Lord only knows how long. So there are some considerations, pro and con, when thinking about growing dry beans. They don't take a lot of land, but they do take some land. You can grow a row of them in your garden just for fun, but you'll probably get maybe a handful or two of beans out of that. So if you're serious about growing them even for your household, then it's a good idea to get a little more land involved. Even a half an acre of land can produce 100 to 200 pounds of beans. So you can kind of figure out the scale from there. They are easy to grow. They are a really nice addition to a CSA box if you have your own CSA or you are in a position to partner with someone who does. Growing heirloom dry beans preserves rare varieties, and growing different varieties of beans, especially heirlooms, also preserves biodiversity. And we know that a more biodiverse landscape is a more resilient landscape and can roll much more easily with the climate change that we're seeing coming. On the other hand, beans are also poor competitors with weeds, so cultivation is paramount. They produce one crop a year, so you plant them early summer and harvest in the fall. That can go either way. For me, that works out really well because I'm not psychologically set up to deal with multiple rotations and successions. So I need a crop that allows me to put one in the ground and just kind of ride with it for the rest of the year. I don't need the crops to be really needy because I get enough of that from me. They can be labor intensive. They are labor intensive. I grow 1 acre of beans every year, and I rotate between 3 parcels. So there's a couple of years between each bean crop in the same parcel. 1 acre is the upper limit I've found to what one person can manage on her own without killing herself, and I'll spare you the details of how I found that out. But I do everything by hand, which sounds kind of insane, but heirloom dry beans really do not lend themselves to any kind of mechanization. In theory, I could harvest with a combine, but I'd lose 30 to 40% of my crops because unlike soybeans, which have this upright, almost military kind of bearing, they're straight up and down, my heirlooms tend to be a little more on the relaxed side, so they're more like, hey man, whatever. And they kind of slouch this way, and some of them vine and cover the paths, and in general sometimes are kind of a pain to deal with, but it's doable when you're using hand tools. I threw that in there because I'm really proud of how those rows look. Different year, this was from probably, that's 2 years ago. So then, why heirloom beans if they can be, a little bit of a handful? They are, like all beans are, legumes, so they're a low input crop. You don't have to give them anything. They fix nitrogen from the air, and in doing that, they make their own fertilizer, so you don't have to add stuff to them. I've never added any form of amendment to my farm, and I add fertility using cover crops. They are a low-cost entry into farming. So if you think that you can't farm because you don't fit the profile of what we think of as a farmer, or you think that maybe you're too old or too short or too female or too new at it, then this is something to consider trying because they are grower friendly. And all of the tools that I use are not expensive tools. A good wheel hoe can be had for $250 or less. And on the handout that you got, I've got a list of my tool suppliers. These are the tools that I have used for the entire time I've been farming. And in fact, I bought more tools at the beginning and found that, hey, I don't really need all these anyway. They can be grown, you know, on relatively little land. They contribute to a secure local food shed. So if during the pandemic, we found out about, you know, how things work when you have to bring them in from other places, and that suddenly becomes not possible. But dry beans are shelf stable. They last for a long time. And they can get a community through a period of food shortages. They're also climate friendly because they don't require a lot. They don't need a lot, and they certainly don't need fossil fuel run machines to grow. And they're climate resilient. Beans are tolerant of heat to begin with. And my best 2 years farming were last summer and the summer before, end-to-end drought years. My tomatoes suffered, but the beans did great. And they are, and dry beans are desirable additions to farmers markets and restaurants who really love them. So now we move on to heirlooms and why grow heirlooms. First of all, we have to kind of define an heirloom if we can. And an heirloom is generally considered seeds that are maybe 50 to 100 years old. They typically have been passed through generations. There's no real legal definition of what is an heirloom, so.
Variety, not the seeds.
Yeah. Right, the variety, not the seeds. They're beautiful. They have colors and shapes that are stunning, and which is also why they're not commercially grown a lot, because they don't fit the system that's set up for uniformity and sameness. Some of these are elongated beans. Some of them are great big beans. Some of them, you know, I find this out when I try and set up my Earthway seeder to seed these things. Like, what seed plate am I going to use for this bean? Because the bean plate doesn't work. It's, you know, they're too big. So you find ways around that. Heirlooms are also important to saving, you know, to preserving culture. They come with stories. They come with, you know, not only the stories of how they came to be in a place, but also the stories of how they're grown. And I think that that's really important to a farming culture, is to remember the methods and the cultures and the know-how that goes into growing old varieties so that we don't lose those. All right. Heirloom beans are relatively rare, so planting them and eating them and creating a demand for them so that more people grow them is a way to preserve them. Research shows that the more colorful beans are higher in antioxidants than plain colored beans. They're diverse even within a one acre farm. So I can plant some beans early in the season and they will be ready for harvest earlier than others. So if a rain event takes out one or the other, I've still got a harvest coming. Let's see. What else? This is my stable of tools. We've got the three wheel hoes, and then, let's see, right there is the front wheel of my Earthway seeder. And the one row Earthway seeder is how I plant an acre of beans. It sounds kind of insane, and it takes a couple of days, but it really does work. And I have clay soil, which can be a little challenging to work with, too. But the Earthway was the best $100 I bought when I was early on in my farming career. And it works. And I know some people use a Jang seeder, which I would really love to have, but you know, the Earthway is paid for, so there's that. There are other ways to plant beans. If you're doing it on a smaller scale, you can, you know, jab a hole in the ground and put the seeds in that way. There's a lot of ways to do it, and you do what works for you. On a larger scale, I find that something with a wheel is a big advantage. And then when they come up, this is the cultivation crew right here, or the rest of it. But you know, like I mentioned, this one, the Collinear Ho and the, gosh, whatever that is. This is the Diamond Ho, Stirrup Ho, and then, you know, another all-purpose thing. The only one I really use much anymore is that Stirrup Ho. I can retire the rest of them. So the tool requirements are not great at all. This is a picture of the field. That's last year. So this is what I've gone to control weeds now, because I have a major quack grass problem. And when quack grass isn't a problem, then the Canadian thistle is. And it's too early to tell about how this works with the thistle, but it works very well in eliminating quack grass. Let's see, not this past year, but the year before I tarped, and I did a couple of cultivation passes, and the quack grass left me alone for the rest of the summer. And the wheel hoes take care of all of my cultivation, so it's, you know, push them down, row and back all for maybe two or three times, and then that year it was done until the work was pretty much done out there until harvest, which is a weird experience having a couple of weeks of not a whole lot to do except walk around and look at how pretty they were. Insect pests are not an issue on my farm. I'm still kind of waiting to see what happens with that. The worst pest problem I ever had was several years ago when the Japanese beetles moved in. And they only chewed on a couple of rows in from the side, from the edge of the farm. And I went out there with a bucket of soapy water twice a day and just hand knocked them into the water. I'm a little afraid of, you know, if reincarnation really exists, that I'll come back as a Japanese beetle and pay for all that murder. But it really did work to keep the next breeding population down. And the other thing I found out was that not having a zero tolerance for weed policy on the farm really helped. So I intentionally leave some velvet leaf to grow up, because the Japanese beetles like that best of all. If there's velvet leaf in the field, they'll go for that and leave the beans alone. So if you can get a weed to do some of your work for you, why not? So the process for growing beans is pretty simple. There are just some considerations to keep in mind. And these are things that I didn't know when I was starting out, but now you get to. So we covered planting. It's pretty straightforward. The important thing is to get the rows straight. I took some shortcuts with that and kind of paid for it, not only because it looked weird from the field and I got to hear about it from the neighbors, but because I keep 2 feet between my rows. I may increase that to 3 feet for some varieties that tend to cross with a neighboring variety a little bit more readily. And I just found this out this past year when I got some really interesting crosses. And not all of them are attractive, so I'd kind of like to keep them from happening again unless I want them to happen. But planting something else, planting a row of beans, and then something else 2 feet away, and then another row of beans between varieties that, you know, I'm worried might cross, seems to be effective, because bees, if they're going to pollinate beans, are going to go from plant to plant within a row. It's too much effort to expend to jump over a couple of rows. My beans don't tend to cross all that readily. So I haven't had a lot of experience with that, but because they're self-pollinating, as the blossom opens, the part that receives the pollen brushes up against the pollen part, and then they're fertilized right there. Yeah, they're self-pollinated. But crosses do happen. It's kind of the fun of growing heirlooms, because, you know, there's this element of what's going to happen now. So you won't have everything that you think you need when you start out with this, but constraints make you interesting. I started farming with no land, no money, no experience, no know-how, without most of what you need to start farming. But I did want to do it, and so I pieced things together and made do, and those resulted in some really interesting interesting workarounds that I still use. I found that, okay, you can solve a problem with money, but I didn't have money, so what's another way to do this? One of the answers is work a little harder, but you can only do that so long. But you want to work with what you have because you don't really need a lot. I did spend money on the tarps because that seemed essential, and several years of studying how this might work convinced me that they would pay for themselves, and they have. So a timeline, timelines for growing beans, after you put them in the ground, after about 6 weeks, they start to blossom. A week or two after that, they form these little tiny pin pods. And then maybe a couple weeks after that, the pods start drying because the plant is withholding water from around the bean. And after about, say, it's been 9 weeks, the pods start to crisp up. And you know that it's time for harvest when the pods are crisp and you can pop them open like a peanut shell. I hand harvest. I've tried several methods for harvesting. And have decided that hand harvesting pods off the plant in a bucket and taking them out of the field sounds like it wouldn't be a really efficient method, but it is. The first year, my first year I did hand harvest, you know, all of these, but I didn't have a way to thresh and winnow them. And it was a good thing that, and this is on the farm that I learned on, I think I had, two-thirds of an acre. And so my husband and I spent the entire winter hand-shelling all of those beans, and we watched a lot of movies that winter. And by the time we were done, we could commit the perfect crime because we no longer had fingerprints. So you probably don't want to hand-harvest much. Although I still do hand-harvest the pole beans. They have to be hand-picked, and they're kind of labor-intensive and putsy, but If you find a pole bean you like, they're really great. I'd love to grow an acre of all pole beans. So harvesting, when I got a little bit better at harvesting, I still hand harvested the pods, and then I put them on tarps and hit them with something, and I tried all kinds of things. I tried a stick, I tried a plastic baseball bat, I tried rolling them up in the tarp and stomping on them. I tried backing over the tarps with the truck because that is actually a recommended way to get the beans out of the pods. I don't understand why it didn't work. They were dry enough. Dry wasn't the problem. So I went back to the hand-picking thing. One year I pulled all of the plants out, roots and all, just all of them, put them on a tarp and then hit them that way. Which kind of worked, but you know, 5 hours of beating on something really takes it out of you, and then you think you have to get up the next morning and do it all again, and doesn't sound like a good idea. Plus, the dirt from the roots got all mixed in with the beans, so I had a really filthy harvest of beans that needed to be cleaned up, and that just added another step. So what I saved up front, I paid for in the end. So hand harvesting is the way that I'm going to stick with, although the way to handle the harvests that now are better than my first years is to get a crew out there. So instead of, you know, picking these by myself over 2 weeks, I want to get a crew of, say, even 5 people out there for 2 consecutive days, and we can probably take care of the whole thing. It's really important to harvest the beans when they are ready. They will hold on the plant for a little while, but not indefinitely. And if there's going to be a rainy spell, that won't do them any favors because that starts the decay process. I've harvested beans that have went through a couple of rainy cycles 1 year, and they were okay. A lot of them were still good, but I did have a lot that just weren't saleable because they'd, you know, they got, the pods would get little water spots on them, and that would over time transfer to the beans. And they didn't look very good. I kept them, some of them for house beans, and they tasted just fine. But if you're looking to sell beans, then you want them in as good a condition as you can get them. So timing harvest for around a rain event is really important. I would rather stay out in the field really and harvest beans for like 2 weeks straight because I think it's just a fun way to spend time. But in the interests of keeping my beans in good condition, it's just gonna have to go a little faster this year. But that's an ongoing thing that I'm working on. You find out where your pinch points are as soon as you solve a problem. So cultivation and weeds were a problem for a long time. I think I've got that figured out. Then we got the good yield. And then the bottleneck became getting them out of the field fast enough. And then on top of that, what do I do with them when I get home? So what I after they're harvested, I bring them home, and I have 2x4 frames that are about the size of a sheet of plywood, so 4x8, that sit on top of sawhorses, and I dump the pods on there and then stack those. So far the sawhorses can handle them too high, and we're gonna try 3 and see what happens this year because we don't have a lot of space in the yard. And they will hold there for quite some time, and I cover them with tarps at night to keep the moisture off of them until we can get them threshed and winnowed. This past year was the first year that I got something with a motor on it, and this turned out to be kind of a game changer. And I bought a BCS tractor so that I could have a mower, and I got the flail mower attachment so that I could control my cover crops.
Do you like the flail mower?
I love the flail mower. It's heavy, it's a beast, and I don't know that it likes me very much, but I can control my cover crops on my timeline now instead of having to, what I was doing is renting a mower, trucking it out to the farm, using it, having to keep an eye on the watch because, hey, I've only got 4 hours and I still have to get this thing back there. And it's just really not convenient. And when things are not convenient, you tend to not do them. So I used this to take down some, an acre full of weeds, weeds, free cover crop, potato, potato. But now I can also do a deliberate and intentional cover cropping of my 2 acres that are not in bean production every year. And I can do rotations of those cover crops and take them out and mow them, feed the soil, and do that throughout the season so that nothing goes to seed. Okay, this is the thing that I'm probably most proud of. As far as cheap tools go. This was born out of necessity with threshing. So the whole beating with the stick and the tarp thing wasn't going particularly well. And I cribbed this from some YouTube video where somebody was using this to thresh wheat and thought, well, if it works on wheat, then why not beans? And so we got this. So there's this length of, where are you? There you go. This length of threaded rod. And a hole in the lid of a 5-gallon bucket. Now that top end of the rod goes into a cordless electric drill, and on the bottom here we experimented with all kinds of things. We tried coat hangers, they broke. We tried a heavier gauge wire, it was hard to work with, and it got to the point where some of it was really beating up the beans badly and cracking them, and that wasn't any good. So these things here are the, what are these? These are attachments for a lawnmower, where you cut up the stuff and cut up the grass in little bitty pieces and leave it lay on there. A mulching mower, that's it. Attachments for a mulching mower. So we put a couple of those on there, top and bottom, so they get all the beans in the bucket. And that's my husband there. He's the thresher-in-chief. And he loads up this bucket, spins this thing around for a while, and then pours from the bucket into that box, into that cardboard box there in front of a retired box fan. And the box fan does the winnowing. Sure, why not? So we pour the beans from the bucket in front of the fan, which blows the pods, the lighter pods, into the driveway. The heavier beans fall in the box. We do that two times, and they're pretty darn clean, and there's no dirt in them. And that's one of my major advantages when I'm selling the beans. I mean, I don't like to think about competing with other growers. But there is something to be said for having what Land Stewardship Project calls your unfair advantage. And everybody's got one, or will have one. And my unfair advantage is that I bring beans to market that are clean and kitchen ready. They need a rinse and they're ready to go. So the instructions that you hear often in, you know, on the backs of, you know, bags of beans from the store is, you know, pick out the rocks. There are no rocks in my beans. So my unfair advantage is, you know, kitchen ready beans that I can take into a chef's kitchen and they are ready to roll. They don't have to do a thing about that to get them prepared, except rinse them off and then cook them. Oh, and this whole setup, by the way, totally free. 5-gallon buckets are everywhere, and you know, lots of people have a drill around, so you might have to invest in those mulching mower things, but that's it. And once beans are harvested, threshed, and winnowed, they do need to dry down before you can package them or store them, because they're still getting drier on the inside where you can't see what's going on. So even though I'm harvesting maybe at the end of August, in a good year, or mid-September, I want to plant them so that they're dry by mid-September or the third week in September, because I go to market 4 weeks, 4 Saturdays in October. That's it. A harvest season happens, and then I take them to Mill City Farmers Market on 4 consecutive Saturdays, and that's the bean sales. But I need them to be absolutely dry, because I don't want to hear back from somebody who had a moldy bean because it wasn't dry enough. So it takes another 2 to 3 weeks once they're threshed to completely dry down, and I just figure that probably means 3 to 4 weeks, just so I feel a little bit better about it. And still, you know, I have to go through like 2 weeks selling at the farmer's market and not hearing back from anybody with any bad news before I'm convinced that it really worked. But that's just me. You can tell that beans are dry enough if you try and dent one with your fingernail. If it dents, it's not ready. The method that I use most often, though, is I set one on the sidewalk and hit it with a hammer. If it smushes, it's not ready. If it shatters, it is. Oh, yeah, the hammer thing? Yeah, the hammer thing's way more fun. And it, you know, it's a fun little exercise. Here, could you go hit some beans for me, please? Let's see. Carol Deppe is is a bean grower whose books I really love, and I agree with her sentiment here. Home is where the beans are. And home really is where our beans are, because when harvest season comes, the place is, the decor is beans. There's beans on the table. There's beans everywhere. So, you know, if you really love beans and you want to grow them, then you're in for a real treat here, especially when people come over. Let's see. Okay, at this point, does anybody have any questions about the growing process? You know, getting them from seed to, yeah, right here.
What do you put them in the ground?
Oh, good question, yeah. I aim for a June 1st date, but that's modified by the existing conditions in the field. The beans need to be planted in soil that is at least 65 degrees day and night. If you put beans in too cool a soil, they will just sit there and rot. So it's worth it to take a little extra time, make sure that soil is good and warm. I stick a thermometer and measure it, and measure down 6 inches, even though I'm only putting beans in, say, 1.5 to 2 inches deep. It's just that little buffer zone that makes me more confident that I'm planting at the right time. So June 1st, give or take, I've planted as late as the third week in June, but that's getting cutting it kind of close because beans are sensitive to day length. And even though they come up and everything, and they just do so much better when they get the proper amount of sunlight when they need it. You don't really gain anything by planting them early. It's not like trying to get the first tomatoes to market. Did I see another? Boy, it's really hard to see. Yeah, right here.
Oh.
Hi. I wonder if this is fascinating, by the way. I'm so excited. Thank you. Can you speak to the difference between, or your experience between pole beans and bush beans, or are you more a bush bean type and versus pole?
Oh, I like that. Let's see. I started with bush beans because they're the easy entry in. You know, they get about 2 feet tall. They're right there. They're at working level. They're easy. Pole beans take a little bit more because they need something to climb up. And a lot of the varieties will get to be, they'll climb as high as they have something to climb on. So I have a trellis, two rows of trellising. Again, that's kind of a jerry-rigged sort of construct. But I use T-posts and then tie a top line of something from one to the other, and then put up this trellis netting that I get from Johnny's. I think the brand is Hortonova. I have mixed feelings about using that because it's plastic, but it also does a really good job. So I just take care of it and use it year after year after year and make it last. I've been using, my first couple of years, I use this polyethylene kind of rope stuff, but that stuff frays in these little bitty pieces and I really hate it, so I don't use it anymore. I'd use something like jute or a natural kind of rope, but when that gets wet, it also stretches. And the point is to keep the trellis tight as you can so the beans got something to grow on instead of this kind of saggy thing, which, you know, gets them up off the ground, but little else. So this coming year, I'm going to experiment with a rigid top pole and just lash that to the T-posts. It'll be a little more work, but I think it will, first of all, last longer, and second of all, it's lightweight metal. Last year I had one of these, kind of a soft-sided shed that I kept my BCS and my tools in until a really bad storm blew the thing, you know, over. And so I'm just using the parts to build trellises, but you can do that. I'm also thinking of rebar. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that I'm thinking about for the top bar, and I might have a hybrid system where I use rebar over here and the metal over here and something else down the line, and, you know, because once it's covered with beans, who cares? Pole beans, let's see. Pole beans are easier to cultivate because, you know, they're up off the ground. But the drawback is they're a little harder to harvest because I hand harvest the bush beans, but I can just grab handfuls of those and dump them in a bucket. And with pole beans, it's more like one at a time. So you gotta want those to grow them. But I do want a couple of varieties really bad and bad enough to grow these things. And
when you're harvesting with the beans, how do you time that so that you can harvest it when it and then it'll shatter?
The line there is, well, first of all, not all of my beans are prone to shattering. So I've identified a couple of varieties that are, and I get to those first. Those are the bush beans. And then there is one variety that I grow where the pole beans do tend to shatter. So it's just a matter of allocating time. And sometimes it doesn't work out great. I will lose some to shattering, but it's not a lot.
Is that information published as which varieties are shatterable?
I don't know. For me, it was just a matter of trial and error. I can tell you, though, that if you're interested in growing Swedish dry beans or Swedish brown beans, they're great. I think there's a lot of demand for them, you know, in the upper Midwest and especially in the Twin Cities, but they easily shatter. I mean, they're like, they're unreasonable. they're like, you're not here, boom, on the ground, and there you go. So if you want to grow them, you know, maybe, I don't know, get something under them or just camp in the field. I don't know what you do about that. But at least in my on my farm, I've grown them a couple of seasons, same kind of thing. They shatter. So I am leaving those to a more intrepid farmer who wants to deal with them. You know, sure, let's throw in some questions. There's
questions over here? Okay.
Two things. Do you irrigate at all?
No.
Okay.
I don't. I did irrigate when I was on my incubator farm with drip irrigation. I have access to water, but I don't use it because all that drip tape gets in the way of a good, clean cultivation. And second of all, I want these crops to learn how to deal with the existing conditions that are out there. So I've got seed that I have saved for something like 8 years. I mean, not the same seed, but I save seed from year to year. And so they are accustomed to the conditions on my farm. So if it's a drought year like it has been the last couple of years, they do fine. If it rains and they get a little more water, they do fine. But they're just going to have to, I want to teach them to be a tough crop and kind of deal with it themselves.
Saves you a lot of time too.
Yeah.
Irrigation takes a lot of time. The one other question, have you ever tried using a wash machine, an old wash machine at all?
No, because I don't have one.
Okay.
But I would love to see one in action.
That sounds like a good farmer's share project.
Yeah, it does. That's a great share project.
Oh, if I raise your hand, sorry. So she's breeding for resilient heirlooms. That's great.
And then, of course, the ones that make it are the ones that get planted next year. So,
if you source a new variety, are you more likely to buy all the pounds of seeds up front or grow out your own seed for that first season?
I do kind of a mix. I have a regular stable of beans that I grow every year, and then I'll buy seed, one or two varieties of seed to experiment with every year. And then I like to say that I'll try a new variety and I'll grow it out for seed first. And then the following year we'll see what happens with it. But it usually ends up to where there's enough, because I usually buy about half a pound minimum. And there's enough there to where I can't help it. I'll take some to market just to see how it goes. Did that answer your question?
Okay. So a quick question. What do you mean by shattering the beans?
Oh, okay. When the pods get really, really dry, sometimes they just spontaneously burst open. So it's not the beans that shatter, it's the pods. But when the pods shatter out in the field, they drop the beans on the ground. And, you know, when you get to them, you don't know how long they've been there and how long they've been absorbing moisture from the ground. So they're, you know, it's not something, those aren't something that I want to harvest and either eat or sell. So once they're on the ground like that, unless I see it happening, those are lost beans.
Do you try to let them grow to form another plant or for next year's planting?
I'm sorry?
Do you try to let those beans that shatter just grow where they are, or do you use them for next year's planting?
No, good point. I haven't, because I don't really have the time to kind of collect them all and then see that they're dry enough.
Well, more like they shattered on the ground. I'm not going to pick these up. I'll just let them grow where they are.
Well, they probably will germinate and grow, but they won't get to maturity that season.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Wait, sir, just a minute. I'm coming. It's being recorded. They make those recordings accessible to everybody. That's why the mic.
All right. Hi, thank you for the presentation. Do you have any suggestions for a good pole bean that could be seeded at the same time with corn that wouldn't overtake the corn crop?
I wish I did. I have tried growing pole beans up corn, and it's my corn variety that's the problem and not the beans.
Is there information for anybody familiar with growing Three Sisters? That would certainly address that.
Yeah. What variety? There's.
Here, wait. Share this with everybody. This is good stuff.
My experience has been that if you plant your corn in hills rather than in rows, you got a fighting chance. If you got a bunch of beans going through rows, you got a mess.
I agree with that. I plant some corn it's flint corn for cornmeal next to the bean field, which is actually they're right next to the pole beans. And every year it happens that the pole beans go up and then they find something else to hang on to and they always land on the corn. So there's this, kind of a mess of beans with the corn. And, I just let it go and figure I'll pick it apart later. But, you're probably right. And I think planting the corn in hills is probably a better idea. But I just haven't found a good blend of corn and beans to grow together yet.
We have had some luck in our home garden, Three Sisters planting. On our small vegetable farm, we grow some heirloom dried beans for our CSA, but they're all bush beans. For our own home use, we do some pole beans in the Three Sister style, and we've had luck with transplanting the corn at the same time as we direct seed the dried bean and the melon or squash. And we were using Pawnee Blue as the variety of corn, and that seemed to work pretty well.
Is it a tall variety?
It is.
Okay. Yeah, and that might be the problem that I've had. I grow a variety of flint corn from Vermont, and it doesn't get really tall. So I think that's where the failure comes in.
You mentioned earlier the way that you plant them, you try to avoid the crossbreeding. What is the crop that you use in between to kind of buffer?
I experimented with cilantro one year, and it worked just fine. The only problem is I don't like cilantro. So I come out to the farm and get out of the truck and think, what in the world is that smell?
So it doesn't matter really as long as...
So commercially with seed, I'm working on a project in Malawi, actually, with heirloom seeds. We call them underutilized seeds, basically the same thing. And we're looking at a bean called Bambara nut, and we're looking at proso millet, which is finger millet, which is a grain like corn. Huh? So there's isolation distances, is what they call it, for making seed. And beans are 10 feet. And it's true. I mean, this is, the thing is, you say, well, I can see the next year I get some, but maybe the following year you could have some genetics in there, recessive genetics that show up in your next generation of seeds. So if you want to do the purest way, you keep isolation distance. It's not so much interplanting, but that's, depending on what your goal is, your markets, your objectives. I just thought I'd share.
10 feet between varieties.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll do, I do a little bit of that buffer thing just between a couple of varieties that I know are going to cross in a way I don't like. But there's other ways around that, separate them with another variety, for example. Keep the ones that are they're called bush beans, but they tend to have this vining habit to them. And if I can keep them away from the other ones, then my chances are better that there won't be a cross.
I have one more quick question. Great job. You mentioned earlier that 1 acre is the upper limit for a human of your name, and so when you talked about that, how much do you plant in 1 acre? Like how many pounds of seed go in?
Okay, I'm supposed to know the answer to that. It varies from year to year. I try for 300-foot rows, and pretty sure that's what it is. A pound of bean seed I'll plant a row with 1 pound of bean seed or 300 feet, whichever comes first. I'm looking to expand that this year, and the way I'm expanding my farm is not by acquiring more acreage, but I have a buffer zone at the far end of it that I haven't used for a few years, and I'm going to extend into that. So let's see. I figure approximately 1 pound of bean seed per row. So then I need, and the number of rows varies from year to year. Last year I was worried that I wouldn't get a crop at all, so I stopped at 17 rows. And this year it'll be more like 25. Mm-hmm. Which is a lot more than it sounds like, by the way. This is a picture of a variety called Lena Sisko's Bird Egg. And this is my go-to bean. It's a bush bean. It's a really lovely all-purpose bean. I got my initial seeds from Seed Savers Exchange, so stop by their booth. They are at the shelling stage here. You can let them go all the way to dry, or with these beans, you can pick them at the shelling stage, which is when the pods are getting flexible, and there's a little bit of wiggle room at the top. You can kind of define the feel as leathery. And you can pop those open and cook those shelling beans, and they are just a whole other vegetable. And there's beans, and then there's shelling beans, and you rarely see them at any kind of a market because they're even more labor intensive than the dry beans are. But if you can ever get your hands on them, and they're extraordinarily expensive, but buy them anyway.
So tell us the variety name again.
Lena Sisko's Bird Egg.
Slowly.
Oh, sorry. Lena Sisko's Bird Egg.
Oh, Lena, L-I-N-A?
L-I-N-A, yeah.
Sisko, C-I-S-C-O?
Yeah, like the fish.
Like the Sisko seed, okay.
Yeah.
Sisko kid.
Yes.
That's okay. Do you, have you ever taken some at the shelling stage of a bean that can go to dry and then, you know, let more come back and let those go to dry? Like, do you know how it works for production? Because it seems like I take a lot of beans for shelling, and it seems like they just keep pumping them out the more I take. But then I'm also, you know, I've let some of those just go to dry and see if I can use them as seed or something. But I'm just wondering if you've had that experience.
I have to really stop myself from picking a lot of shell beans because they're so good. So I pick some, but mostly my goal is to have more dry than shell beans, because I don't sell the shelling beans, but I do sell the dry beans, so I want to make sure that I have way more of those than shellers.
So it doesn't impact yield, do you think? I don't think so,
because I'm not taking that many out of there. I'm saying, but if you grow that variety, you do want to pick some of those for your own use. I haven't noticed but I haven't noticed any effect on yield.
Like hurt or help.
Right. Yeah.
So are beans considered determinate, meaning they do everything all at once, these heirlooms, or is it indeterminate where they're little by little by little are ready for picking?
They're little by little until they're all dry.
And once they're all dry, they stop putting out flowers.
They put out flowers that turn into pods, and then, but these there's always some that are producing blossoms in October. I mean, I know that they're not going to make it, but it's just so cute to see them.
Can you share your retail prices?
I sell at the Mill City Farmers Market. I sell these beans for $9 a pound at Mill City.
And are you certified organic?
I am not certified organic. I did the certification for a couple of years, and it took more effort and time to do all that paperwork than I was willing to take away from the farm. And organic standards are my baseline. And that's where I start, started, and the practices that I use are far beyond what organic certification requires. My customers don't care. I have a good relationship with my customers, and they trust that I am using the practices that I say that I'm using.
And you're telling your story.
Yep.
At the markets and such.
I also have, you know, kind of an open gate policy on the farm. People can come out if they want. There's actually no real gate, but people are welcome to come out and see what's going on out there. And, you know, they'll find a lot of beans, and they'll find tools, but nothing that you wouldn't want to see So I use all of the practices, but I just go far beyond that.
What are the cover crops? You mentioned of all the inputs, cover crops are pretty much the only thing you use for the soil. What are your favorites?
Well, I like buckwheat. It does a nice job of weed suppression. And now that I'm able to control my own cover crop, I'll plant winter rye again.
Oh, yeah.
I really like winter rye. And beans seem to like following winter rye. So I wanted to highlight this writer. Her name is Virginia Nazarea, and I heard her speak at a Seed Savers Exchange camp out one summer, and she was marvelous. But she's written a book called Heirloom Seeds and Their Keepers, and she writes about a perspective of seed saving that, you know, we don't often think about, and that's the one of memory, where we grow seeds to preserve their stories, their names, their memories, the memories of the people who grew them. I mean, in my own family, I can say I don't have a family history of farming, but my mother's father did farm poorly, and that's, I guess, why the family doesn't talk about it. And then his father was farmed before he came to this country from Ireland, and he farmed when he got here, but it was not what you'd call successful farming. So my mom was less than thrilled when she heard what I wanted to do. But in the intervening generation, all the information that was in the family at one time about farming was lost because nobody talked about it. There was nobody to tell it to. And so that leaves people who are new to farming, who don't have that history, to have to start all over basically from scratch. So when there's more of us who are growing these and telling our stories about this and keeping them going, the risk of that kind of loss happening again is minimized. And I think that's really important. I just threw this in here because I like their baby pictures. And this is a happy accident from last year. There were some crosses and one variety through more kinds of genetic variation than you can count. So we might have the makings of what you'd call a new heirloom here. The parents are heirlooms. This thing right that you see back up there was from one season, so it's a little early to tell. But with heirlooms, it's fun to experiment. And Carol Deppe, who I mentioned earlier, is a seed breeder in Oregon, and she found that she was roguing out different a variety of beans that was kind of this really pretty medium brown, and there were genetic variations in there that were dark brown, and she was picking those out for a while and then thought, well, what the heck, don't do that. And she found that her yields were better with the mixed batch. So, you know, it's fun to experiment with these things. You might have something new.
So roguing, for those who aren't familiar with that term, roguing is to pull out something.
If it's
off type, if you're growing things for commercial seed, you don't want it pure. If it looks different than the other guys, it's out of there.
Yeah, take out what you don't want what you think you don't want, but you might want to leave it in there. I did that with one variety of beans because I thought, oh, my customers are going to wonder what's the problem with the beans. There's the dark ones and there's the, you know, the splotched ones and all kinds of things. Well, as it turns out, everybody wants those because they're just gorgeous, you know. Okay, this is from my farmer's market stand, because if you're going to do this, you really got to love it, and it's worth it to have some fun. This was, Halloween. So I've got Yurik there and his message to the market shoppers. And that's just the last day of the season because bean jokes are funny. You've got this and a few other things on your handout. I can recommend all these books heartily. I brought copies of those books up here if you want to thumb through them. I've also brought seed catalogs from the seeds that, from the seed sources that I buy from, and I've got examples of five beans that I either plant or have planted. And I also, in retrospect, I probably could have put my name and email address up there, but, you know, hey, hindsight. So I've got cards up here with that information on there if you want them. Oop, there we are. All right. Oh, thank you.